You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
Coffee is a language in and of itself, with a rich and complex history. It travels the world wide, and at times it is borderless, uniting people and cultures in conversation, the glue that binds our social encounters. Similarly, it's steeped in an intricate web of politics and economics. It has built nations and is destroying them. It's perpetually intertwined in the global economy. Coffee is power. Considered a fruit, this agricultural product, with its own symbol on the market known as C, is far from that of simply being a product. It's a concept, a culture, a moment that, without fail, always invites strong opinions, much conversation, and most definitely a bit of controversy. It's the most complicated beverage we consume, and there's no denying coffee is incredibly sexy. With so many variables to explore, tonight we frame the conversation specifically on sustainability with input from four local experts. Their insight puts a face on coffee, and hopefully after this discussion, will have enriched your appreciation for the people and the processes behind it. As a curious consumer myself, my perspective immediately shifted the moment I stepped onto Jay Ruskey's farm, Goodland Organics, up in Goleta, California, where he and his team helped me understand the fragile ecosystem within which coffee grows, the painstaking labor involved in the harvest, and the multi-layered process to prepare the bean for market. As you delve into the depths of the cup, you'll discover that coffee truly is a form of communication, because each cup, even a bad one, tells its own story of how it got that way. Tonight, we are very lucky to have one of the leading thinkers in the field moderate our conversation. With over 25 years of experience, Peter Giuliano has lived every facet of the industry, from that of roaster, buyer, and educator, to pioneering what is known as direct trade, which established a standard for how coffee is ethically sourced. Peter currently works for the Specialty Coffee Association of America, based in Long Beach, as director of the Coffee Symposium, a national conference that serves as an incubator for ideas in coffee, where industry folks meet to discuss the future, to innovate, and to push coffee forward. Peter will do the honors of introducing our other panelists in further detail. So without ado, please help me welcome to the Los Angeles Public Library, Peter Giuliano, Jay Ruskey, Angel Orozco, and Alexandra Catona Carroll.
Wow. Maureen, that was the best possible introduction. We were in back, like, completely thrilled by that because I think we all agreed that you said some things that we were going to say, so.
We don't have to say much anymore.
Yeah, but anyway, that was great. My name's Peter Giuliano, and I have the honor tonight of leading a discussion about coffee through the lens of sustainability. So I'm going to attempt to lead a little of this conversation, but I'll introduce you to each of the speakers and let them introduce themselves. But first, I want to sort of build off of the introduction, the wonderful introduction that Maureen gave. And one way that I always start conversations about coffee is to remind us all that coffee is inherently, quintessentially, and originally Ethiopian. One way that I like to explain that is by saying when we're drinking coffee, we're all eating Ethiopian food. And that's because the Ethiopians were the first ones to discover and roast and drink coffee. Coffee is native to Ethiopia, where it grows in the mountainous, forested southwest of the country. And that may be a surprise to you that Ethiopia is forested, and it is. It's beautifully forested in the southwest, and that's where coffee grows. And that's where they learn to pick it and roast it and drink it. And from there, coffee moved throughout the world, first across the Red Sea to Arabia, and from there it kind of went out like a spider web throughout the whole world. And it got as far as here, in essentially the global polar opposite of Ethiopia, Southern California, and where it is grown and roasted and consumed like it was in Ethiopia. And that's an amazing transformation, how coffee came from a small plant in a very localized area and consumed in a very localized area to being this global commodity, this global food web, and this global connector of farmers and roasters and baristas and consumers in the whole world. Coffee is an everyday thing to us. It appears on our breakfast table every morning, but it carries with it some indication of its exotic origin. It might be called Sumatran coffee, named after the island in Indonesia. It might be Ethiopian coffee with a name that you can't pronounce because you've never seen it before. Or it might have a Spanish name, and that's very familiar to us in North America because much of our coffee comes from Latin America. And we'll talk about that as well. But that web and that giant food web is a challenge and an opportunity for us because to sustain the agricultural nature of this plant and the planet that it grows in, and to sustain all the people that work in the this web of coffee, and to sustain the economy that drives it, is a challenge for us. And it's our challenge and our opportunity, and that's what we want to speak about today. It's something that's captivated my life. I started, and I still consider myself a barista, which was my first job in coffee 25 years ago. And shortly thereafter, I got fascinated by this web and sort of trapped in the web of coffee, and I've never left it since. So that's my coffee story. And we thought we'd begin this discussion today, which is about coffee sustainability, by telling our own coffee story and how we came to think about coffee as more than just a beverage, and instead as our life's work and something that we could use to sustain our livelihoods. So to my left, to your right, is Alexandra Katona Carroll, who has her her own coffee story to tell and has an interesting job, but I'll let her tell it. Alex?
Thanks, Peter. If you want to know the origin of anything, ask Peter. He probably knows it. I am Alexandra Katona Carroll. I work at the Coffee Quality Institute, and I am the programs manager. I'm also a member of the Sustainability Council, and I just wanted to thank all you for coming out today. It's so great to see everyone here. My coffee story, I went to the University of Michigan, and about my junior year, I worked with a professor, Yvette Perfecto, and I loved her. It was about a social justice class, and on the side, she does a ton of research for coffee, and I say on the side because that's her life's work. And she had some grant money to play around with, basically, and invited three undergraduate students to figure out what to do with this money. I didn't know anything about coffee, and I didn't know even that it came from a little cherry and where it was grown. I knew nothing about it as a junior in college. So started doing some research. Three other students and I took an old master's thesis that kind of outlined a bunch of different cooperatives in Chiapas, Mexico, and we ended up just choosing one randomly based on the master's thesis, and we worked with a cooperative in Chiapas called Yaxchil Xochibol Chuchan. I'm sure I'm not saying that right. And we worked with them for a couple years and actually started importing and roasting coffee and selling it to the Ann Arbor community. And since then, I've been in coffee, since, 2004. So it's just been a really fun journey.
And thanks, Alex. And then to Alex's left is Jay Ruskey, who is one of the few coffee farmers is in this geographical radius. But I'll let him explain that, Jay.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you for all showing up. It's amazing to be here and see everybody. I am from Los Angeles, and I don't have a farming background. And my story starts here in L.A. I went to Loyola High School, ended up going up to San Luis Obispo with an interest in agriculture, mainly cut flowers, and my folks bought a farm in Goleta, California, which is about 650 feet in elevation, 2 miles back from the ocean, mainly avocados and cherimoyas. Since then, I've developed many different crops. We've become certified organic. It's a 42-acre farm. It's now 23 acres of production. But what brings me here today is the coffee. I started working with the University of California Farm Extension Service. They do a lot of work with crop introductions. We tried lychees and longans and failed, and my friend Mark Gaskell was like, well, try these coffee plants. So I planted them in some moderately producing avocados, and they survived the winter. And then we tried some more. I killed a few, and which is part of the learning process. And today we're now have over 500 mature trees. In fact, that's Santa Barbara in April right there, that image. And we have developed, I have a company called Goodland Organics, which is on my folks' farm. And we are now been finishing what I call a 7-year feasibility study, understanding if there's a potential to do coffee. And it looks like it would work if we interplant them with avocados as a shared crop. And as well as we've done a hybrid of what you'd probably see in Kona and what you would see in Santa Ynez Valley, of having some coffee educational tours. So everybody in the region and even a lot of locals can come up and see the processing of the coffee, which is relatively unknown and hard to see. On top of that, our beans are on the tree longer than almost anywhere else in the world. So if you come up in June or July, you'll see red cherries, green beans, and flowers at the same time. I know I'm getting towards my time, but here are some pictures of some of our processing. These are the cherries. Picking red cherries are quite important. And I'm a newbie in this coffee world, sitting up here on stage, so I kind of just take elements of growing other things and apply it to coffee. We have, if you come to our farm, you'll see a wet process in which we take the cherry, which actually has 2 seeds per cherry, and remove it. It goes into a big vat of water where undeveloped beans float and the fully developed beans sink. We actually leave them on in the water, and there's actually a fermentation process. You never thought there was fermentation involved. You think it's only with wine, but the fermentation removes the mucilage or the meat through bacteria and fungi. Then we pull them out and we dry them, and there's actually a shell that covers the green bean. And that shell gets removed. And you have a green bean that has even a little skin on top of that. You can see a little silk skin. So what I've been learning and is that there's this whole post-harvest side that is as essential as growing a good cherry, because you can grow a good cherry and ruin the coffee. And I think that's kind of what I've been bringing to the table here. And we can talk more about it later.
Jay made me change one of my basic coffee lessons. When I would teach people about coffee, I would explain to them very carefully that it was impossible to grow coffee in California. So
there's more to learn.
Yeah, there's always more to learn. Over there is Angel Orozco, and I'll let you tell your story, Angel.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Angel Orozco. I'm the founder of Cafecito Organic, which is the coffee you had tonight. I am originally from Guatemala, but I grew up in L.A., and my story with coffee started when I was doing some work as part of my master's thesis in Guatemala, looking at deforestation, and particularly in the northern part of Guatemala. But I had a good friend who was from the highlands of Guatemala, was working with indigenous coffee growers, and I was given a sample of coffee from some growers who were having trouble marketing their coffee because it wasn't certified organic. But it was grown organically. Most small farmers, particularly in Guatemala, do grow their coffee organically, but for financial reasons choose not to become certified. And so it was limiting for them to be able to market their coffee to the organic, which would dip. This was back in like 2001, was more of a niche market. And so I brought some samples back to the U.S. and I started experimenting with coffee roasting at home. So for the most part, I pretty much taught myself the craft of roasting, starting with a home roaster and then moving up in size in terms of batch sizes on the roaster. At one point, I essentially decided that I wanted to start a business where I can be of better assistance working with some of the indigenous farmers in terms of getting their coffee into the market. And so I had the good fortune of stumbling into Mama's Hatamales Cafe, which was a business incubator in MacArthur Park. And I was given the opportunity to incubate my business there and essentially operate the coffee bar that they had as part of that. Eventually, in time, I took over the management of the space and got really involved with working in MacArthur Park with street vendors. The whole premise of the Mamas Atamales was to help street vendors become formalized so that they wouldn't be getting so that their food wouldn't be getting thrown out by the police or the health departments. So I started working there, and in time as the business developed, I moved from eventually, you know, from a comb roaster to a 1 pound roaster, and then into a 7 pound roaster, and then my tenure eventually finished at Mama's Atamales, so I had to find a place to roast. And I live at the housing cooperative at the Los Angeles Eco Village, and I had, again, the fortune of operating there out of a garage. So if you guys see in our bags, we do mention that we kind of started working out of a garage because we essentially did as many things. So, you know, learning this whole thing about street vending, then I kind of went back to that right after working with folks. And so I started doing farmers markets, and on the one hand by chance, but also intentionally, because I felt that coffee needed to be looked at the same way we would look at any other product that we consume, that it should be fresh. You should also get to know where it comes from in terms of who the producers are. So since then, since 2010, which is when I first opened my first retail store, I took on a partner at that point. And after 3 years, we now have 5 locations. We're still doing farmers markets. We're now involved with another business partner who helps us with design work as well. And let me go through my slides. So one of the things that we believe as our business is that we believe that coffee can enhance and protect livelihoods and biodiversity. And one of the neat things about coffee is that this is one of the farms that we work with, which is one of the coffees that you had tonight. It's called La Montaña. And they have an old growth forest there, and the coffee, it's hard to tell, but it is being grown underneath. And so we like to support, and this is from an estate, so we like to support farms that are working with stuff organically and are also contributing to protecting and enhancing biodiversity. But, you know, coffee, as Jay will explain, it's hard work, and particularly in Latin America, it is very labor intensive. And as you can see here, someone carrying about 100 pounds of coffee in their back after picking. And it is also very much of a family enterprise. Interestingly enough, in Guatemala, the school system is sort of designed around the coffee harvest. So school ends in October when the harvest begins, and kids go back to school in January. And so you see here the entire family being involved in harvesting the coffee. Here, this is, again, people weighing in their coffee to get paid at the end of the day. And one of the things that you probably have seen in our bags and literature is this whole concept of café o muerte, you know, coffee or death. And we have these three principles that help sort of guide our work here in the U.S., which is, you know, looking at coffee as a stimulant, you're looking at coffee as a career, and coffee as social commentary. And with the idea of coffee as a stimulant, you know, for many of us who depend on coffee, you know, most mornings it's going to be either coffee or death, right? Because, you know, we have to get our fix. And one of the things that we try to do at our shops is make sure that we can facilitate that process in, you know, in a in a professional way, and obviously in a friendly way, and also taking an artisan approach to how we prepare the coffee. Make sure that you're enjoying a good cup of coffee, and also connecting you with some of the elements that we're going to talk about tonight in terms of the industry. One of the things that we're finding now, we're talking in the back about, in terms of whether we saw ourselves looking at coffee as a career, and I never really thought about my involvement in coffee from that perspective, but in being involved as a business, we're finding that a lot of young folks are coming into coffee and looking at it as a career. And we're trying to do our best in terms of making sure that we provide those opportunities for the folks that come and work with us. And, you know, this picture kind of illustrates a little bit of that. We have to the left, Yesenia, who's one of the brokers that we work with, who's involved in coffee now. And then to the right is Margarita, who is a quality control specialist in Honduras. And interestingly enough, Honduras, we see a lot of women are involved in the quality control aspect of it. And the two folks that were serving the coffee outside, you know, are also looking at coffee as a career. Mary had been in Chile looking at coffee there. And then Michael is, and I don't know if you had a opportunity to read, but he's pretty much a coffee geek, and he's got a lot behind him. And then, you know, coffee as social commentary. And that's something that that brought me into the industry in terms of trying to see how we can address the inequity that exists in this industry, and it's very rampant. And so it's one of the things that we've been trying to see how we can address through the little volume that we do and the direct relationships that we form. And also, you know, coffee houses historically has also been places of gatherings for social commentary as well. So we're trying to see how we can facilitate that process through the stores that we have. And obviously, like this forum tonight is part of that, right? And so that's my story.
Cool, thank you. Yeah. One thing that occurred to me is, as everyone was talking, is we're here to talk about coffee sustainability, right? And one of those key words that comes up when we talk about sustainability in coffee and other agriculture, as well as organic, this word organic. Good Land Organics is the name of your company. Cafecito Organico is the name of yours. There's this underpinning. This is an element, right? And, in addition to all these other things, which I hope we get to. But my observation as a coffee person has been that most consumers, people that consume coffee or other things, they think of organic as being the absence of pesticides. You know, this means that there's no pesticides in my food. But I wonder if that's what I saw. I saw a reaction from you when I said that. What does that make you feel like, that thing?
Oh, the word organic is always debated. I actually have a background in market research and ag business, and I did the first consumer behavior research between farmers market vendors and conventional store vendors. And one of the words was organic. What does that mean? And we found that organic means different things to different people. Some people think it's pesticide-free farming. Some people think it's organic is best for their children. You know, and it means different things through their different lives. And now organic is being defined differently by regulatory bodies. We now have the USDA involved. We now have our third party, like CCOF, involved. I now have County Ag Department involved. I have everybody else telling me what organic is, too. So it's the word that has matured into a new realm for us. And what's going to happen is now we have local organic. So we're having little spin-offs. And this is the nature of the word in the markets. And so it probably means something different in Guatemala or Chiapas too. So it's good we have it. I'm happy for it, and I'm happy it's being used. That's a great moment, but now what's the next organic level? What is it going to mean? And that could be sustainable.
And one of your first teachers you've mentioned, Yvette Perfectos, who's worked a lot with evaluating organic farms as an agricultural technique and stuff. What's your perspective on this conversation?
On
organic or certifications?
Sure. Well, why don't you explain that nuance?
I like doing this. When you buy coffee, how many people look for certification on a bag, just by show of hands, that influences your decision on whether you're going to buy it or not? Can we have a couple?
Yeah.
That's interesting. I thought it'd be more. it did not work.
It's always a risk. You take a risk when you do that.
It's LA.
For me, it's kind of tough because I'm so involved in coffee that I see kind of people doing all sorts of things. I see people putting organic on their bag when it's not certified organic, and I kind of go back and forth with that because that kind of leads to this slippery slope where people can start putting anything on their bag, like fairly traded, where they don't have to say fair trade, mm-hmm. and they don't have to pay for the certification. So, yeah, you know, it's tough because you can trust a cafe, you can trust an owner, and you can talk to them about their practices, and that probably will give you more insight into what they're actually doing. But I do feel like certifications do play an important role, and especially making sure we're giving back to the producers directly. I know there's a lot of people doing that on their own, but if you're just wanting to get a cup of coffee, it's really hard to determine who's doing what if there's not a certification on a bag. So I do go back and forth on that a lot because, you know, now we're seeing it with direct trade. We don't have enough time.
This whole concept has evolved for you a lot. We talked about, your first experiences working with coffee farmers who were working organically but couldn't be certified. And then you've traveled since then to many countries and worked with lots of different farms. Tonight, you showed us a picture of a farm that is not only organic, but also is practicing this agroforestry technique. Can you explain a little bit about that? Because I know that's part of your background.
Yes. We've gone back and forth with the certifications as well. And for the most part, just because of how the labeling works with regards to organic, we don't use it in any of our labeling or in our bags or on our website. Despite the fact that our name is Cafecito Orgánico, but we don't use the term Orgánico from the perspective of being organic mm-hmm. or organic certified. We use it more from the perspective of it being a natural product. And we do use fairly traded. And part of that has been just our frustrations with the fair trade movement. We use sustainably grown in our labeling as part of that. And over the last few years, we've been using our social commentary on the whole aspect of the certifications. We came up with something that said grown on earth by humans, and we put an alien face on it. And that was sort of our commentary on it because we're being frustrated and getting bombarded by this whole idea of organic, and regardless of where it came from. Right. I mean, with coffee, we are dealing with an international product, but we're trying to do our best to localize it and in terms of how it contributes to a local economy here. And obviously as to where it's grown. So we've been talking to Transfer USA in terms of getting registered with them to start carrying that label. We've been looking at our facilities becoming certified organic so that we can use that organic as well. So it's things that we're exploring now, especially as we dwell more into the relationships we have with the producers and want to make sure that the premium they get for the certifications is sort of brought to the public in a very transparent way. But ultimately, a lot of them are getting certified for the sake of the premium, not necessarily because they care entirely about the environment, but they do. Most of them, one of the things in sort of my work in Guatemala that was this whole idea of conservation through use rather than conservation through set-aside policies, right, which is what we've seen lead to a lot of different problems in Guatemala, for example. And so ultimately for a lot of them, it comes down, you know, to be able to, you know, put food on the table. And so the certification, you know, helps towards that, but in situations like we're facing now with the rust bug fungus, you know, the whole organic stuff just goes out the window. It comes to an issue of being able to commercialize your product. So So it's an interesting time to be involved in coffee, and I think the more we delve into it, the more challenging it becomes,
right?
Especially with the relationships.
And this this thing that one thing that was is interesting about the picture you showed and some of the things you said is this idea of, well, you talk about conservation through use, right? This idea of preserving ecosystems by using them as, you know, agricultural locales. And that's really interesting, right? And one of the things about coffee is it likes to grow in a forest, essentially. It likes to be protected from sun. That's how it was in Ethiopia where it evolved. And so there's all these different techniques about growing coffee in different places and achieving that. Angel showed you a picture of one in Guatemala that's a beautiful, we'd call that a shade-grown coffee farm, which is this model of environmental sustainability because it's such a good way to preserve ecosystems. But in talking with you, Jay, I got intrigued by this avocado shade system that you've got gearing up. Tell us a little bit about that whole deal.
Well, I have a different perspective. I don't have the experience you all have of going down and seeing all the shade grown. I do, from ecology standpoint, if I was going to protect an ecology, I actually wouldn't touch it.
Yeah.
It's 100 million years of biodiversity above ground and below ground. But say it was touched and you have to go in there and do something. And you want to do something that's sustainable, but you have two types of sustainability you have to look at. You have ecological sustainability, but you also have a community of sustainability. And so if you said, well, you see that picture, and it was somewhat deforested for the trees, I'd say, well, where is the food crops to support the community? Because basically everybody's growing everything and we're shipping it to the United States. And so what I am kind of focusing on, and I'm not, you know, we're in the chaparral of Santa Barbara, you know, I'm going to existing avocado farms that are now getting moderate prices. Labor is going up, water price is going up, and they're still farming avocados basically the same way they were 20 years ago. Is what can we do to increase the yield and production of every cubic foot of that farm? And so we're looking at what I call the layered food system, in which, well, we start bringing in some plants that, like the avocados, like the shade, and producing locally. And so from a sustainable standpoint, you know, I have ship things all the way across the United States and some export, but I also supply locally. And I would love to see that some of that sustainability have some food systems to support the community in there. Instead, and it needs to be a balance because I think, yes, you can't just live on food alone. You need to buy other things, and that coffee can inject cash into that community. So there, I'd like to see a little bit more of a balance in that shade-grown system. And in our, you know, in our high dollar real estate here on the California coast, we have to maximize our potential. We're still weeding that area. We're still putting water on that. And we need to support our labor year round. Coffee's a good one. And I think we're getting close. As long as we can produce a very good cup of coffee that people want to pay for and experience. And we have the technology for it. And we're finding that even organically we have the technology for it. And that's it's good that we, with all the NOP rulings and all the big fertilizer companies are coming with to us farmers and giving us some more cost-effective products. And that's helpful.
And so you're actually producing coffee seedlings that will be available to other farmers, isn't that?
Yeah, I just partnered up with a friend of mine, and we have a nursery. So I have 13 varieties of coffee on my farm as part of a trial. Mainly we have Catura and Geisha and some Typica. And I had another trial I didn't do too well on because I planted too late in the season. Now I know to plant in April through July, and that's it. But we now have 10 varieties, and my goal is to establish those varietals through vegetative cuttings and seedlings and be true to type, because this is a problem in this industry, is there's a lot of variations and discussions about varietals. But it's also a marketing thing, a business decision, because now you look on the bags of coffee, we're seeing up, fair trade, Guatemala. Oh, Pacas, Catura, blends. Wait, we're kind of following that wine route. We're going to get certain beans, like certain grapes, and we have a wet process, but maybe we're going to try a dry process where we leave the cherry on the bean so we develop more of that cherry flavor and that sweetness and make something unique. It's kind of like the wine industry in California. It's very different than France because France is, they have a very specific flavor. It's middle of the road, but California, we like our flavors kind of bounce and big and unique and different. And that's what I see in the coffee industry. Everybody likes that unique flavor and gives the roasters something to do, the challenge to optimize that bean, you know, and it makes it a very exciting cup of coffee.
Right. So I don't know if you noticed, but we've actually got, we're actually flanked by coffee plants here that are from Jay's farm, and they're two different varieties. Do you want to tell us about that one over there?
The Pacamara. Yeah, they're two different varieties, and from everybody's perspective, you can see how different they are. The Pacamara is a Bourbon hybrid. There's mutations in the hybrids, and that's a whole another discussion I'll let you work on. But you see, this one develops a very big bean, but you can look at the leaf structure. The leaves are fat. It has new vegetative growth that is bright green, these big lateral branches that are running about 90 degree to the base. It's a well-respected newer variety. And then on the other side is the Leroy. Can you believe a coffee named Leroy? This is supposedly the naturally decaffeinated one. Yeah, it has 20% the caffeine level. But if you look at it, it's almost Christmas tree shaped. The ones in the field look a little more central leader-like. Very pointy leaves, copper new growth, and there's actually green cherries on here, and I'll bring it out after the so you guys can see it and touch it. The cherries are really long, and so it's a very unique and rare varietal. And so I wanted you to see some of the vegetative differences and bring the farm to you.
Yeah, that's amazing. So here we are talking about, you mentioned wine and I know Alex, you've got interest in other craft beverages, you know. So maybe explore some of these parallels that we have. You know, we're talking about varieties. He's used this word and the wine analogy. Is coffee ready for these kinds of analogies?
I mean, for me it is. I'm not sure if it's ready for the general public. I'm really interested in craft beer also, kind of looking at the... And obviously I like wine. I like all beverages. but just looking
Cheers.
At, you know, the crossover in the craft industries and, you know, really what's cutting edge and who's doing what. Interesting to see how craft beer has kind of really taken off on this sour beer. And if anyone's tried sour beer, but it doesn't taste like beer, really. It's kind of crazy. But it's this kind of cult following where people are really interested in sour beer, and the fermentation process is way longer. It's a much more arduous process in general. Kind of looking at coffee, and I think of these really acidic, super interesting coffees coming out of East Africa right now, some in Central America, where Jay mentioned they're dried and processed much differently, where the fruit stays on, and there's this really, really complex flavors, and I think it's fun, but I always hear people say, well, I don't like acidity. It hurts my stomach. It doesn't really go the same way in coffee, but I think as craft beer has really done a good job of bringing this following of, you know, people who like sour beers. I think it's going to be interesting for specialty coffee to really talk about what acidity really is, and it's not a bad thing, and it's not going to hurt your stomach. It's actually delicious and interesting and complex, but I'm just not sure everyone's ready for that because it is complicated and it is weird at first if you're not used to it. So, you know, it takes a lot of communication, it takes time, it takes, you know, just tastings like we had here today, which was really fun. So there's so much to talk about, yeah. But the crossovers are pretty interesting.
And one of the things about beer, right, is like there's this small craft brewery movement happening, and that's been happening in coffee too. I mean, Los Angeles has been this locus, this sort of amazing place for coffee. I'm not sure if all of you Angelinos are aware, but we're in a place that is experiencing this coffee renaissance right now. I was just sharing that the two, we just had the Specialty Coffee Association where I work just had a supports this the United States Barista Competition. We just had the Southwest Regional, and the winner of the barista competition was a barista from Venice, California, and the winner of the Brewers Cup, the person that makes the coffee, is from Los Angeles as well. So we're in the hot spot here. Right on.
Woo.
But when we talk about small entrepreneurship and these kinds of networks, I'm interested in how that's reflected on the producing side too. Angel, I know that you, when you brought the coffees for us to taste today, you brought one coffee that was from a farm, a large or medium to large size farm in Guatemala, but also from a cooperative in East Africa, which is what you were mentioning. Can you talk about this distinction here about co-ops and estates and some of these differences here?
Sure. The co-op that we're working with goes by the name of Sopakdi, and they're from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which was a very difficult coffee to get out of the Congo, too, just because it's been in war. So the coffee that we received actually took a while to get to us because of that. And then the other one comes from Guatemala, which is much easier to get here. But the for us, I started working with cooperatives initially at a point where triple certified coffees were very popular, this whole idea of shade grown, organic, and fair trade. And I think over time we've moved in a direction of diversifying who we work with because we wanted to look at the aspect of biodiversity and how a large estate can contribute towards that. And also, you know, a lot of these coffee farms employ a lot of folks too. So in terms of looking at livelihoods, in terms of how a large estate can support that. Then from the small growth perspective and working with co-ops, it's a little bit more interesting for me just because it feels a little bit more accessible in working with different farmers at different levels of both quality and involvement in the industry. And this recent trip that I did for coffee buying, we visited a co-op in Honduras by the name of Capucas, and they're doing some really great things. One of the reasons why I shied away from co-ops initially was that, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is a lot of them would compile all the coffee from different producers. So you had varying degrees of quality that was sort of consolidated, and I think ultimately would either reduce or improve the quality of the overall coffee. And lately, cooperatives are starting to make a little bit more distinction at the producer level. And this co-op that we're working with in Honduras is doing that. So we're sort of exploring the cooperative aspect of it because of that. And it allows us to get smaller lots of coffee with different degrees of also experimentation with regards to the farmers. So we're kind of moving direction. Although we still continue to work with large estates, because we are establishing good relationships with them, and we are working with different partners in the industry that can at least help us in terms of verifying the practices that they're employing at the farm level, particularly when the farm is not certified organic or any type of other certification. Though I know Transfer is starting to explore the idea of providing a fair trade certification to estates. So that's going to be interesting when that starts to happen.
And just to, you know, moving, just explaining that distinction that you are making, I think a lot of people aren't aware of the fact that up to now, the fair trade label has meant cooperatives. That's really what it is. And a cooperative in coffee is the term we use for when a number of farmers, usually very, very small farmers, and when I say small, I mean 2 or 3 acres of coffee farm, which is teeny tiny, as Jay and all of us can talk about. That means a few thousand pounds of coffee in a year, And so it's not very much. Because they're so small, they band together and try to get some economies of scale by sharing purchases of inputs. You know, if they're buying fertilizer, they can do it together and get a better price. If they're marketing it, they can export it out of the country together and save on costs that way. But as Angel accurately described, that means mixing the coffee together, and that's us choosy coffee people don't like mixing stuff together because so that's one inherent tension in co-ops. But I think many of us that have worked in coffee like working with co-op. You had some early experiences with co-ops, which are the center. They become the centers of communities, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they can do social programs. In fact, the fair trade certification includes a premium that goes to the co-op that gets distributed in the community. So that's one distinction that I think a lot of people aren't aware of. Another way people though get connected is through organizations, right? So you mentioned before that you work for an organization that connects people in coffee, including people that work with co-ops and et cetera. Tell me about some of these connections that you've been able to experience through coffee.
Yeah. That's a good question, comment. I work for the Coffee Quality Institute currently as a programs manager, and we really do work with everyone from seed to cup. So we work with producers and exporters and importers, and we're trying to work more with consumers. We actually have a certification for quality, which is brand new, and you probably haven't seen it on any bags yet. But it's almost like the wine spectator kind of thing, where a producer can get a coffee certified essentially and get a number by it. So this, coffee could be rated a 91, which is a pretty great rating. And we're trying to be an independent certifier of quality, which hasn't really happened yet in coffee, but we've seen before with beer and wine and all this. So it's really interesting to see, as part of CQI, working with all these different types of people in the chain, kind of the needs and what they're looking for, and being able to connect buyers with sellers, farms, like we said, estates, cooperatives, people looking to find really specific markets that they have a hard time reaching to or getting connected with, and being able to just connect people, maybe like a Cafecito Organico or someone looking for a specific flavor profile to a producer offering that type of coffee. So it's been interesting working with everyone in that chain. It's always hard to explain what I do because everyone thinks I sell coffee, but I don't. We just try to connect people, and that's really the driving force behind CQI.
Yeah, and some of these people are coffee tasters, right?
We have a huge cadre of tasters. We certify the majority of what we do is not certify coffee. We actually certify trainers to taste coffee, and this sounds weird, but a lot of people who grow coffee have never tasted their own coffee before. So it's how do you enter a market without knowing what the heck you're selling? So a lot of it is just here's what it tastes like, this is good and bad, and then making bigger distinctions from that and understanding, acidity and profiles and body and specific nuances to really be able to market that coffee instead of saying, I have some coffee. Now you can say, I have a coffee that has a rich nuttiness, maybe with some chocolate finishes and a smooth aftertaste. So, being able to try to link people and help them kind of find markets for good coffee.
Which is an important part of sustainability, right?
It's huge.
That's what's happening behind us, right? And this is this arcane ritual that we have in coffee that we call cupping, which is tasting coffee in an organized way and talking about rich nuttiness and chocolate undertones. So,
pillowy bodies.
Yeah. As Angel mentioned, women are oftentimes involved in this at this level in the marketplace. Yeah. I've been told by people that are smarter than I am about taste science that women happen to be better tasters of everything than men are. So it doesn't surprise me to see to see women working in the cupping room like that. And that's been your experience, I know?
Yes, especially with Margarita is part of the dry mill that processes the coffee for the co-op. And the quality control department at the co-op is run by, I think Hector was his name. And he was having a lot of trouble really coordinating with us in terms of setting up the cupping and the roast. And but when we got to the mill, there was an entirely different experience. And she was more on top of it. And well-organized and a great palate. And as soon as we were done with our stuff, she kind of just opened up and started talking about all these different nuances in the coffee. Yeah. And whereas on the other side of things, it wasn't like that. The guy was more like looking at us for guidance than anything else.
You know, a testament to this tasting and where the market is maturing is if you want to become a master sommelier, as of July, you have to have a specialty coffee chapter and certification.
Is that right?
So wow. They've just incorporated that into the sommelier training.
I love
it. It's the higher level, but that is, and I've confirmed that too. But and that kind of shows it's now coming back into the high-end food, you know, where you finish your meal with a dessert and a geisha coffee to compliment it, you know. So that's kind of exciting.
Yeah. And you do all your own tasting in on your farm. You've explored the nuances of the flavor of the coffee.
Yes. I've learned the hard way, but I have, this last year, I've really focused on the flavors. We've actually had William Boot do some coffee tasting. We have Miguel Muniz. And we've gained the high A's on both Arabica and Geisha, which is really a shocker for us and was really where... And I think it came from a couple things we did in the field, but more importantly, what we did on the post-harvest, trying to keep really systematic control. I think one of the things like co-ops are really good at is saying, well, you know, one of the easiest things you can do to increase your quality is pick red beans. You look at that picture, you know, earlier there was 30% with green beans, and everybody's being paid by the pound, so guess what happens? So there's now incentive programs in these co-ops where there's a quality incentive. And that is the single most important thing they can do is pick a cherry that has proper sugar development. Then, you know, then the co-ops can provide the technology and the techniques to make sure that they don't lose that quality. But if you don't have good pickers and don't have good incentive programs, you're not going to make that quality scale.
Right, and that's an important thing that all farms can do, right? And it's something that we don't think about as being part of this sustainability story, which is optimizing the quality that you can get from your farm, which optimizes your flavor attributes, which optimizes the price that you can get for your coffee.
And we call that dynamic optimization.
It's wow.
It's changing every year. You know, we're talking about rust, you know, that big... You know, now they have a new dynamic. They have rust. So how is that going to affect the fruit? How is it going to, you know, are they going to force them to pick early? I mean, there's a lot of variables every year. That's the dynamics.
Let me explain. Rust is a fungal disease of coffee that is, you may have heard in the news. It's hit the news pretty hard in the past couple of months that Central America has been being quite literally devastated by this particular disease. And it's going to affect the coffee quality and total amount of the crop for this year. So it's a kind of a hot topic. For us coffee people, we're in back talking about, you know, fungi. And we had to get interrupted to come out here and talk to you people about fungi. So, we could talk all night about this with each other, but we wanted to make sure that there was the opportunity to answer some questions from the audience. And I already see some hands, so... I think some of the people from the library are going to walk around with a microphone. Yes.
Oh, hi.
So raise your hands.
Okay, so this is for Jay. My question was whether there's a profile, an identifiable profile for the coffees that you grow in California. Would you say it's similar to what you see in Costa Rica or Hawaii, or are you there yet?
Yeah, that's a great question. I let other people do the profiling. And that's why I took my cupping to professional, well-known cuppers who have different perspectives. Our cherries are on the tree longer than anywhere else in the world. Yeah, I think that gives us an opportunity for a unique flavor and unique profile. Yeah, as well as I have this geisha, and there's this geisha trend kind of infiltrating the specialty market, and somehow I got lucky to have that on top of things. So I was able to cup them side by side. Miguel Muniz did a cupping in Hawaii and put us against three different islands at three different elevations, and he said it was closer to a high elevation Hawaiian coffee. And it's probably, you know, a shade-grown coffee has premium attributes because it's slow. It gives the ability for the cherry to ripen slower and stay at a high sugar level longer. When you're in the tropics in full sun, that cherry's red, and you have to get that off the tree immediately because it starts nesting, breaking down, fermenting, and off flavors. In Santa Barbara, we get June gloom and July, and the cherry sits there, and we pick it, and we have five or six harvests, and we have like seven different blooms, and so we have something unique going on. I'm not trained to give that to you on the profile, but you can go to our website and see some of the quotes of the professional cuppers have given our coffee.
Let me thank you for a very informative talk about my personal drug of choice, coffee. I have a question because my father-in-law used to make me hand-roast beans. He had 100-pound sacks of green beans from all over the world. Twice a week he would lend them, and I'd have to hand-roast them. CD versus vinyl. What do you think about roasting?
What did he say, CD versus vinyl?
Vinyl, yeah.
Oh, sure. Shall I take it, this one?
Take it.
I have an opinion about CD and vinyl, and I have an opinion about coffee roasting as well. But, I started my roasting career on a hot air popcorn popper, you know, I think. And I was working as a barista, and I thought roasting was cool, but the only way that at that time they wouldn't let me come near the actual big, scary machine roaster. So I started to freak everybody out in my neighborhood by standing out on my porch with a hot air popcorn popper. And I made the most incredible, mind-blowing coffee that way, to me, because I had roasted it myself with my hands. And when you do something yourself with your hands, it's incredible that way. But then scaling up, we have this habit in coffee. You'll see coffee companies talk about their, antique European roasters. They get really fired up about their antique roasters. And this is because pretty much the entire coffee industry is roasting its coffee on technology from 1910. You know, I mean, it's like we're driving Model A's. When we're roasting coffee, and that's because we're dedicated to tradition. We love big cast iron machines, and you'll see some amazing pieces of equipment. I've been able to work with some really amazing pieces of equipment that are 80, 90-year-old coffee roasters. So that's a treat to do, too, and those are kind of the two extremes. I'm not going to declare one the winner and the other the loser, because they can all make really, really delicious coffee, and they're appropriate for different places. I will say, since we're here to talk about sustainability, that's one of the challenges that we have in coffee. We're working with early 20th century equipment, and that means that we have challenges when it comes to air quality and energy use. And so, interestingly, there's another. There's a Californian company that's been developing very, very energy efficient coffee roasting machines. And I would say that's an interesting facet of the coffee industry that's growing right now. How to optimize, recirculate air, do things like that can roast coffee with a lot less energy use. And that's really intriguing to me.
That's the type of roaster that we use.
Oh, cool.
The loring.
The loring, yeah. Right on.
Reduces energy use by 80%.
That's very cool.
It's essentially smokeless.
That's unusual and very cool.
Hi, thank you for your time. Have you heard anything from the farms with the bees? Does that affect the coffee industry at all with the bee colonies and their destabilization?
Did they do any bees in the co-op in Chiapas that you worked with?
Not there, but in the community they did, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Are you talking about from an agricultural standpoint or in terms of making another... Oh. Well, I don't know if you can speak to this, but coffee is mainly self-pollinating. So it doesn't need bees like other crops may need them. They're less important to us.
Right. There was an article about how the flower is using caffeine to train the bees to come back.
Oh, really?
Nice.
My mom cut that one out for me. But actually, in California, the bee industry in the last 2 years has stabilized a lot more. And I'm in the middle of this world where in avocados where people bring 50,000 hives from Minnesota, winter them in Santa Barbara, then take them to the valley in the almonds and get big money, then bring them back for the avocado bloom, and then drive them 2,000 miles back for the clover fields. So we have bees everywhere, and it bothers me because I know something is wrong. I don't know what it is to drive bees more than I drive my kids. But they need to be there for many different reasons. Luckily, the plant has adapted itself not needing to be cross-pollinated for production.
First, have you guys heard of this animal that poops the coffee beans and its price is extremely expensive?
You know,
is for you.
And second, what determines the price of coffee?
Wow.
Fecal matter.
Yeah. No, by the way, our number one most challenging question that we get asked is about this animal. And so we'll pass over that but go to this interesting question, like how do we value coffee? And Alex, why don't you talk a little bit about all the dynamics about how coffee gets valued?
We're not going to talk about Kopi Luwak for a second?
Yeah, sure.
Don't buy it. Anyway. So how we value coffee really is about cupping, like we talked about here. You can see these women cupping. And it really is a more scientific process, as Peter mentioned. It's the SCAA, the Specialty Coffee Association of America, has standards for cupping, and we really geek out on these standards and making sure everything is formatted correctly. And really what we focus on is we have different attributes for every time we cup, and there's a form. Usually we do it quietly, so we're not influencing each other. But really, quality is really about what's in the cup, and that's taken in at all different levels. So we first grind it, and we smell it dry. It'd be really fun to show you a cupping one day, but if you Google cupping in YouTube, maybe you can find some people slurping. But, you know, we smell it dry, the aromatics, and then we pour hot water over it, we let it sit. And so it really is this process of understanding everything from start to finish. It takes about 40 minutes to an hour, a cupping does, if you're doing it well. And just being able to taste everything from, as it's hot and as it cools, and how coffee can really change over time, and seeing if it stabilizes or if it destabilizes and then comes back. And coffee really is very, very complex, and being able to cup it to me is really, or even just brewing it is really the way to figure out what the quality is, but brewing it properly, obviously. So, and that's kind of what we do at CQI, is we really use these standards from SCAA and implement them all over the world so people can be trained to cup on the same level. So we're all kind of speaking the same language of quality, and it has taken a long time for us to get there, and, still got a long ways to go.
Why don't you talk about importing, Angel?
It's, at least my understanding of it is a lot of the importers will add a premium to whatever the market is indicating the price is. And a lot of it depends on whether the coffee has any certification, but ultimately what the cupping score is. That ends up determining the markup that the importer adds. But I think it's a great question because one of the things that I feel is that coffee should be accessible, particularly as we're talking about looking at coffee as wine and hoping that it doesn't go in a direction where it you know, most people can't afford it. We've intentionally have maintained our margin low in order to make this higher quality coffee accessible to the general public. And we've slowly introduced certain or increases in our price, but haven't done it in comparison to folks that are, or other coffee businesses that are handling the same quality coffee as we are. We're still probably 25 to 30% lower in our price. Although we still try to make sure that we have a certain profit margin that we target overall, which, you know, tends to be about 15%. We do have a lot of room to really mark up our coffee and, you know, are looking into it and see where we can do it. And based on also the communities that we go to where it is accessible for them.
Thank you so much for coming out tonight. I really enjoyed the talk. And I just want to shift gears a little bit. I feel like I'm not alone in this room by saying that coffee saved my life, and I know it saved a lot of my friends' lives. For this reason, I believe coffee to be a supernatural elixir and probably the origin of the myth of the fountain of youth, I would say. So my question is this. Do you believe that there is a spiritual, divine, or at least mystical aspect to coffee? And if so, do you believe that coffee is the best argument out there for intelligent design?
Wow. Are you going to choose? You got to choose a respondent to that question.
I can get short answers from everybody.
Yeah. 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 Well, yeah. I will completely agree with you that coffee is magical and inspirational for certain. And then, exploring, there's all sorts of mysterious things about coffee, by the way. We just recently learned what its genetic parents are. We didn't know that before. Before we knew that what its genetic parents were, I was convinced that it was some sort of intentional, engineered brain fuel for the human race. But I'm sorry to say that we have now established conclusively who the natural parents are. And so I can't say that anymore, but that doesn't make it any more exciting or mysterious or perhaps even divine.
All right. Hello. Good evening. I really appreciate the talk. I'm actually now working with a cooperative in Guatemala, and there are about 2,000 organically certified farmers. And they're all small scale. Nobody has more than 2 acres of land, which is small. And they're very concerned about the next year's crop because they are having a lot of rust in some areas, not in all. And we're trying to figure out how can we increase their income in different ways. The cooperative they work with in Guatemala has been proactive in trying to have a sustainable food source for the community because I believe, I forgot your name. Avocado.
Jay,
sorry. I'm
Jay
terrible
Avocado.
With names. I apologize.
No, it's good. Avocado's good.
It's good.
Call me Avo.
Avo. Sure. But I do believe that sustainability has a lot to do with making sure the community is viable and that they don't go through periods of hunger, which right now many of the farmers do. And my question to you is, how can we improve in Guatemala? I completely agree that they shouldn't be exporting everything because then they don't have anything for themselves generally. So they're growing different crops and the non-exportable coffee, which doesn't meet the high quality standards, they're trying to roast it for the Guatemalan market. if we take coffee out of, yes, if we take coffee out of the equation, what would you suggest be another income source for farmers that are facing this very difficult situation? Thank you.
I could mention maybe one or two. I'm sorry, I don't remember your name, you never said it, but when you talked about bees, I actually thought you were talking about beekeeping, which is actually what a lot of farmers, not a lot, but some farmers are starting to do. Companies like Sustainable Harvest are leading workshops on how to be a successful beekeeper and growing your own vegetables. I know this sounds kind of obvious, but it's not really happening in a lot of farms. But there's a company actually that just won the SCA Sustainability Award this year called Pueblo Pueblo that's teaching communities how to grow and harvest their own vegetables and teaching or their own gardens and working with kids to kind of maintain that from, you know, generations up and how to be more sustainable within communities. So I would say beekeeping is definitely one, growing your own vegetables and, you know, the diversification of other crops, like Jay mentioned, avocados, citrus, I mean, whatever thrives in that area. I don't know if anyone wants to mention other.
I would say try tea. It's kind of, there's a lot of similarities in growing climates. You don't have to wait for fruit to get ripe. And then follow the model of what a lot of farmers are doing is direct ship, if they possibly can, package it in non-perishable so that you're developing a relationship with the farmer to get the premium and you're showing transparency without need for certification. And to address his question there, I'm glad to hear you guys are having that type of relationship with your food. Think about if you grew it, what type of experience you would have with your food. And that's what we really want, is people to respect food in that way, where you feel like you're having experience with it, because a lot of the way it's getting packaged and processed, you're not getting that type of experience. So that's my final comment.
And I think that's a perfect final comment. We're going to wrap this up, but we'll be out in the lobby. Please go out there, enjoy some more Cafecito Orgánico coffee and each other's company. And thank you very much. And thank you to everybody here for this wonderful talk.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.